Ayatollah Khamenei says the main enemy confronting Iran is the global arrogance rather than the ill-informed individuals or hired agents stirring up riots. Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified attacks on Kurdish militants there. Also ahead, Ukraine's president says Russian missile strikes have left millions of households without power. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has addressed a group of besieged forces in the capital, Tehran. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Husseini Khamenei said the besieged force should be well aware of the country's main enemy, which he said is the global arrogance. Ayatollah Khamenei said the enemies are trying to spread lies and fake news and paint a dark picture of Iran. That's because, he added, they want to have dominance over the minds of the Iranian people. Also in his remarks, the leader rejected negotiations with the U.S. to resolve disputes. He said the talks will not solve any problems unless by paying ransom or crossing the red lines. Ayatollah Khamenei referred to the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution in 1979. He said the revolution tipped the balance against the favor of arrogant powers in West Asia, dealing a heavy blow to their colonialist policies. The leader added, the creation of the usurper Israeli regime was in line with those policies to maintain dominance over the region. Hakim Asghaya Bria is an academic and political analyst. She joined us earlier with her take on the speech delivered by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution on the occasion of the beginning of Besiege Week.
The U.S. history of relations with other countries, you see that the United States looks at the countries around the world in as one of two cases. One is a client country and the other is an enemy country. An enemy is a country that systematically acts independent of the United States, doesn't want to give ransom to the United States, and, you know, looks for its own interests rather than, trying to take care of the interests of the United States in its region. That is the role that the clients play. Now, Iran, with its revolution, became one of the main enemies of the United States. That is not what we did, but that is what the United States eyes, Iran becomes an enemy just by having a revolution that makes it independent. So here, there are two scenarios. One is that a country is weak enough for the United States to be able to overthrow it, as, you know, the United States has done in some countries where they had revolutions. For example, in Congo, they had a revolution, had an independence from the Belgians. And then over a period of 1 year, you know, they had a coup and they removed Patrice Lumumba and they killed him and everything was over, okay? And they had a friendly government, so to speak. But sometimes you have a country like Iran, which is more resilient, that doesn't, old tactics sometimes don't work. So you need to have a step-by-step and a more hybrid scenario for dealing with that country. And that is what has happened with Iran, that from the beginning, many different, instruments have been used. One of them is negotiations, so to call. But I would like to say that it is not negotiations, but it is coercive diplomacy.
Elsewhere, Turkey's president vows to establish a so-called safe zone in northern Syria amid intensified Turkish attacks on Kurdish militants in the Arab country. Recep Tayyip Erdogan says Ankara will complete that zone as soon as possible. He has long sought to achieve this goal, which has repeatedly been decried by the Syrian government. His remarks came as a UK-based monitoring group affiliated to the Syrian opposition said Turkey carried out fresh raids on the northeastern province of Hasaka earlier in the day. Turkey started hitting areas in northeastern Syria 2 years ago, but it intensified the strike since last week when an explosion in Istanbul killed at least 6 people. Ankara blames the bombing on Kurdish militant groups based in Iraq and Syria. However, those groups have denied the allegation. Damascus has called Turkey's airstrikes a breach of both international law and Syria's sovereignty. The Ukrainian president says over 6 million households in the country have been affected by power cuts. Amid Russia's missile onslaught, Volodymyr Zelensky says blackouts are continuing in the capital, Kiev, and most other regions, including Odessa, Lviv, and Dnipro. He says, however, that the number of affected households has dropped by half since Wednesday. Russia has been targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure in recent weeks. As winter approaches, this has stoked fears of a health crisis and a further exodus from the war-torn country. Moscow says it seeks to push Ukraine to negotiate, but Kiev says attacks on infrastructure are intended to harm civilians, and that makes them a war crime. Our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, gives us details on how the critical situation in Ukraine, including massive blackouts, is affecting the lives of people there.
They're reaching chaotic levels now, the situation for Ukrainian people. Power out in large parts of the country, huge problems with water. The situation is critical, according to Ukrainian officials. And as you say, this may well cause another major refugee crisis into Western Europe. Russia trying to bring Ukraine to its knees, trying to bring it to the negotiating table by making it impossible for the Ukrainian government to look to provide even the most basic necessities to their people. And it could cause significant loss of life, particularly if it starts affecting hospitals. Now, will Ukraine be able to sustain these attacks on the energy infrastructure? The president's wife recently went on television saying that Ukrainians are willing and able to live without water and electricity for 2 to 3 years. She cited a survey which said 90% of respondents said so. It's also important to recognize that Ukraine has become an intensely repressive state. It's banned all independent media. It's banned most political parties. It has a very large and active intelligence agency, the SBU. It has far-right extremist military battalions that round up government critics, and particularly pro-Russian critics, and often kills them. That's been well reported even by mainstream press now. So a combination of that kind of determination, genuine determination by Ukrainian people, and an intensely repressive state means that Ukraine may well be able to sustain these attacks on its infrastructure.
Rights groups accuse the European Union of breaking international law by attempting to prevent refugees from seeking asylum in the 27-nation bloc. It's also claimed EU leaders are discriminating against refugees if they do not originate from Ukraine. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU Home Affairs ministers held an emergency meeting on Friday to discuss ways to address a growing refugee crisis. 281,000 people entered the EU seeking asylum in the 12 months to October this year, a 77% increase on the previous 12 months. But the ministers' meeting didn't appear to offer much hope.
We need to protect our external borders, and we need to return those who do not qualify for asylum and to be under the legal umbrella of the European Union.
Rights groups say this approach is scandalous, considering the EU was able to take in 4.3 million Ukrainian refugees within a few months. Regarding refugees coming from the Middle East and Africa, some member states are furious that other EU countries won't help with the numbers.
Unfortunately, the voluntary mechanism will only relocate less than 1% of total arrivals to the European, to the Med 5 countries this year.
One aid worker has told us he witnessed awful conditions for refugees on the Greek Macedonian border.
I spoke to pregnant women who were sleeping on the floor. I spoke to Syrian young man who was trying to get to Europe to find protection with his disabled brother. Thinking of these people and what is being currently discussed, it's actually scary.
2,000 refugees died in the Mediterranean Sea this year as they tried to reach the EU. The bloc is paying billions of euro to countries like Turkey and Libya to prevent asylum seekers from coming here. Earlier this week, in the European Parliament, the EU's broken asylum policy was castigated.
For the EU, all refugees except from Ukraine are illegal migrants, and yet most of them come from Afghanistan and Syria, countries that are victims of imperialist interventions and wars that the West caused.
It was suggested in the Parliament that EU authorities are racist, that Ukrainian refugees are welcome simply because of their skin colour. Rights groups are also condemning the racism and are asking EU leaders to remember the bloc's values they talk so much about. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The soaring inflation and worsening cost of living crisis in the United Kingdom is triggering more and more industrial action across the different sectors. This time, university staff, more than 7,000 of them, are walking out in what's being billed as the biggest strike in the history of UK higher education. Saeed Poreza reports from London.
This is not a lecture, but a picket line. These lecturers, librarians, and researchers are out here as part of a massive strike across the country. 150 universities are involved in 3 days of industrial action, affecting up to 2.5 million students. Action these students support.
If they're not paid properly, they can't teach properly, and therefore we can't learn properly, and then we're not getting what we're paying for in the first place.
Teaching conditions are learning conditions, and as long as our teachers aren't paid well, they can't teach well.
We think it's really important that teachers get a fair pay, and it's important for our learning conditions as well, so we stand in solidarity with our teachers.
The list of grievances is long. Trade unions say staff pay and pensions have declined by 25 and 35% respectively since 2009, in real terms, while workloads have increased. Lecturers earn an average of $55,000 a year. Academics are increasingly being offered short-term contracts, meaning many have to reapply for their jobs every few months.
People who are having to work more than one job in order to stay alive because the jobs that they get are casualised, their contracts are not secured, and the salaries they get for each job they do isn't sufficient to keep them alive. We've had stories up and down the country of people who, for example, have to live in a tent because they can't afford to pay the rent on a lecturer's salary because they're casualised.
You can't plan where you're going to live, you can't plan having a family, you never know exactly how long you're going to be employed, so you can't plan anything.
The average undergraduate degree costs around $35,000 in tuition fees. That's excluding books, travel, and accommodation. Students from outside the UK pay double or more.
If you're a teacher, one of your tasks is to steer your pupils into a job, to tell them that at the end of the day, education pays off, that it has societal value. But the reality is that some of the brightest minds in Britain are struggling to make a living.
Compare that with the average vice chancellor's pay, which is 6.5 times greater than the average staff member's. This is the latest in a wave of escalating industrial action taking place across the UK. Workers in several other sectors, such as the postal service, transportation, and health, also walking out for similar reasons. Negotiations between university staff and management are ongoing. Meanwhile, frustration among academics is growing that universities are putting profit before people. Saeed Poreza, London.
Now moving on, the living conditions of Afghan people are worsening day by day. Many are struggling to make ends meet while the Taliban rulers have been stymied in their attempts to repair the economy. Rahmatullah Baghban has more from the Afghan capital, Kabul.
A recent Afghanistan welfare monitoring survey by the World Bank is sounding the alarm bell about the devastating living conditions of Afghan people. People are struggling to put food on the table while lacking access to many other simple necessities. Almost half the population has reported a constant decrease in monthly earnings.
We are facing many difficulties, especially in recent weeks. We slid into a bad recession. I work from dawn to dark, selling potatoes and onions. But so far, I haven't even made a penny to buy some loaves of bread for my 6 children. Our house is cold, and I have not bought fuel. I am concerned about the health of my children.
The survey has also found a rise in unemployment rates across the country. More and more Afghans are finding it difficult to land a job. The situation is only expected to get worse during the coming winter months.
We are sitting here in front of this bakery because of poverty and unemployment. We are awaiting people to come here and buy us some loaves of bread. We leave our homes in the morning to look for jobs, but no one hires nowadays. It is becoming very difficult to make ends meet, especially in the wake of the cold season.
World Bank officials have called on Taliban rulers to take action on improving the living conditions of Afghan people. The Taliban says it does have plans, but needs access to the Afghan assets frozen by Washington in order to make them work.
With regards to addressing people's livelihoods and poverty, I confess there have been problems, and the major reason for the economic crisis and deprivation of Afghans is that their assets are crucially frozen. Furthermore, Afghanistan is practically sanctioned. Those who were defeated in Afghanistan use sanctions as tools for advancing their foreign diplomacy, but we are trying to neutralize the effects of sanctions and move Afghanistan to gradually become stable and self-sufficient.
The U.S. withdrew its forces from Afghanistan in 2021, but that has not stopped American politicians from asserting pressure on Afghan people. The war-torn country has not yet got the chance to repair the damage caused by more than two decades of Western aggression. As the winter comes closer, more and more Afghans are struggling. People here believe urgent support from the international community can be a lifeline for millions. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Since the 2008 global financial recession, Europe lost its resources and had no hope of being revived completely. In his recent speech, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has claimed neither the COVID-19 pandemic nor Russia-Ukraine conflict has played a pivotal role in bringing about the current economic downturn in Europe. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, neither the COVID-19 pandemic nor Russia-Ukraine conflict has played a pivotal role in bringing about the current economic downturn in Europe. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has argued. He'd attributed it to growth in Asia instead, warning that there likely will be a return to the good old days in the foreseeable future. Speaking recently at an economic summit in Berlin organized by Stutt-Zeitung, Scholz said that for years countries in North America and Europe had enjoyed a combination of stable growth, low inflation and high employment rates. This, however, according to the chancellor, was an economic exception that cannot be expected to last any longer. Russia-Ukraine conflict and the economic consequences of the COVID-19 pandemic may have expedited the end of this era, the politician opined, saying they were not the trigger for it. Scholz went on to explain that for decades, countries such as Vietnam and Indonesia have mainly been viewed as a source of cheap goods for the European, American, and increasingly the Chinese markets. But in the meantime, the same Asian nations experienced an explosive increase in the number of people belonging to the middle class. Those individuals' purchasing power rose accordingly. This, the German chancellor postulated, is what has led to growing inflation elsewhere. He noted that at the same time, this is a major story of success enabled by globalization. He also warned against deglobalization, calling on Germany and other European nations to embrace more trade with emerging economies, of course, trade by fair rules. An increasingly multipolar world is arranging itself right now, fundamentally anew, a development which is best seen in Southeast Asia, Scholz argued. He hastened to reassure German businesses that they have nothing to fear as their goods will remain in high demand in this new world and they only stand to gain more. Speaking of the current energy crisis in his country, Scholz accused Russia of weaponizing gas exports, adding that Germany had made a mistake in relying too much on one supplier. He vowed that Berlin will never repeat this going forward, meaning that dependence on China will have to be reduced as well. Germany, he said, needs to look for new suppliers and markets for its goods. The chancellor promised to make sure Europe's economic powerhouse sees itself through the coming winter. Meanwhile, according to Euronews, the managing director of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, has recently said Europe's economy is projected to be badly hit by the energy crisis triggered by Russia-Ukraine conflict, with at least half of the 19 countries that use the euro heading for a recession. The horizon has darkened significantly over the last year, Kristalina Georgieva told Euronews recently, adding, 1 year ago, we were recovering from COVID and we finished with over 6% global growth and then two shocks. Omicron and Russia-Ukraine conflict have not only interrupted the recovery but reversed it. The number one priority is to fight and win against inflation. What does that mean? tightening financial conditions, interest rates are going up, she noted, adding, when central banks are stepping on the brakes, finance ministers cannot press the accelerator. The IMF chief did not mince her words, saying the picture she painted of the global economy was unmistakably dark, with a worsening cost of living crisis and momentum slowing down in America and Asia. For Europe, the outlook is even bleaker. Europe is affected more severely by the increase of energy prices. The heat on European economies is such that we actually expect half of the countries in the Eurozone to experience at least two quarters of negative growth. In other words, a recession, she said, without naming the countries. A recession is generally defined as two consecutive quarters of negative GDP growth. She said, just to give you a sense as to how significant the hit on Europe is, our pre-pandemic projections and our current projections differ by half a trillion euros. In other words, the loss of the European people is quite dramatic. In its latest outlook, the IMF estimated the Eurozone to expand by 3.1% in 2022, but just by a meager 0.5% in 2023. Next year, Germany and Italy are projected to post -0.3% and -0.2% rates, respectively. The managing director of the International Monetary Fund praised EU policymakers for providing targeted, timely, and temporary support for households and companies under financial stress and said the main focus should remain on energy savings to rebalance the supply-demand mismatch. But great challenges lie ahead for Europe. She declared, "I am not going to sugarcoat it. 2023 will be tougher than 2022 for Europe. Next winter for Europe may be even harsher than this winter."
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We were talking about people who are greedy, people who are stingy. And we said that is a problem for the entire world, for the entire society, because people like this, they just end up sucking the life out of this world and out of people. And we have to make sure that we do not fall into this, you know, this notion of greed. Sometimes it makes it easier for me and you to avoid greed and stinginess when we know how bad it is. Because sometimes when I don't know how bad something is, I don't really care about it. But once I know, then I kind of try to prevent it and stay away from it. So I want to look at some of the hadith of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam in this regard, where they try to show us truly what stinginess and greed is in reality. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, he says, al-bukhlu jilbabul maskana. He says, stinginess and greed are the garment of humility. I mean, what else does a person wants? We want to be respected, we want to be loved, then we have to give. If we're greedy, we're in fact what? Being humiliated. Now one might ask, look at the rich people, they are respected, they are loved, people love them. Look at fulan, they start to name names who are celebrities, people love them because they're rich. Well, the idea is, the kuffar, the non-believers, or even the believers who are going to that side, they're not seeing things in the scale, or at least in the sight of Allah. If they have, then they would have seen what humiliated these people are. Me and you as believers, we have to look at it from Allah's perspective. When we do, then we can see how humiliated they are. They are the people of fire. They are the people of hellfire. They're not the people of respect. But because we've been so much brainwashed, we're seeing things differently. We're seeing it from a worldly perspective, from a shaitanic perspective. Allah says, "Shaitan yuzayyina li awliya'ah." For his own people, he beautifies things. So a person who is a millionaire and a billionaire, instead of people hating him, people love him and respect him. But which people? Awliya of shaitan. Awliya Allah will hate those people. Why? Because they are far away from Allah. They are the food and they are the wood, as the Quran calls it, of hellfire. So why should I love them? So in fact, they are humiliated. They have worn the garment of humiliation in this world and in the hereafter. And then the Imam alayhi salamullah says, al-bukhlu bil-mawjood su'ad-dhanni bil-ma'bud. When a person becomes stingy in the sense that he does not give what he has, then that is him doubting his Lord. As simple as that. And I think we spoke about that previously, how one doubts his Lord. Now, let us take just a quick short break and then we'll come back and continue.
Dear listeners, you're listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program A Bridge. So we are looking at the hadith that talks about how bad stinginess can be for the person and greed, and how it can destroy a person's life in this world and in the hereafter. One of the results of greed and stinginess is al-dhul, humility. The hadith says, al-bukhlu yudullu musahiba. وَيُعُزُّ مَجَانِبَهُ. It says, greed, it will humiliate those who indulge in it and those who avoid it at the valued ones, the honored ones. So greed, if a person becomes a companion of it, will be humiliated. Those who avoid it becomes honored. When it comes to people as well, they are not loved. The Prophet says, بَخِيلٌ Al-Bakhil ba'idun min Allah. Ba'idun min al-nas. He who is stingy is far away from Allah, far away from people. Qareebun min al-nar. He is close to hellfire. Also, those who are stingy, they have no peace of mind at all. And we know this how? Because the Prophet told us. The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam says, أَقَلُّ النَّاسِ رَاحَةٌ الْبَغِيلُ. The one with the least comfort is a stingy person. The least comfort. Why? Because he sleeps and wakes up thinking about his money and how he can make more. He has no peace of mind whatsoever. Their life is just numbers and business. What kind of life is that? You don't even get to enjoy it here, and in the hereafter, a person gets to go to hellfire, God forbid. So what's the point? Also, the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he says, they will be what? The wood fire in the day of judgment. He says, "Anas, people on day of judgment are of three kinds." And then he says, وَتَقُولُ لِلْغَنِي, fire will say to the rich person, يَا مَنْ وَهَبَهُ اللَّهُ دُنْيًا كَثِيرًا, O you who Allah has given you plenty of wealth, وَاسِعَةً فَيْضًا وَسَأَلَهُ الْحَقِيرُ الْيَسِيرِ قَرْضًا فَأَبَى, and Allah gave you so much than you can think of. And when a person who is humble, who has nothing, asked him, then he refused. إِلَّا بُخْلًا فَتَزْدُرُهُ, that person who became just more stingy, and then fire will consume him. Now, I'm very sure me and you, we don't want to be humiliated. We don't want to be people of disease. We don't want to be people of hellfire. We don't want to be people who are hated by this by people here. So what else do we have? What is our other option? The other option is for me and you to give, to be generous, to help other people. And sometimes we don't understand that the diseases, the problems that we have, is sometimes it's just because of ourselves, because we fail to give. And we ask, why us? Hadith from Imam Radha alayhi salam, he says, إِيَّاكُمْ وَالْبُخْلِ, I warn you not to be bakhil. فَإِنَّهَا آهَةٌ لَا تَكُونُ فِي حُرٌ وَلَا مُؤْمِنٌ, for it is a disease that never happens to a free man or a believer. إِنَّهَا خِلَافُ الْإِيمَانِ, for it is against belief. So sometimes when we become stingy and greedy, we put ourselves in harm's way. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
اللهم صل على محمد وآله, اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has intensified its attacks against Palestinians in the month of November. However, what Israelis cannot sabotage is the spirit of resistance among Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept noted, for 3 weeks this fall, Israeli regime forces closed all roads leading in and out of Nablus, a Palestinian city of 170,000 people and the economic hub of the occupied northern West Bank. As residents of the city and surrounding villages were locked in or out, cut off from jobs, school, family, and access to medical care, Israeli regime troops entered the city with armored vehicles, placed snipers on rooftops, shot at homes, and reportedly blocked medical crews from aiding the wounded. At least 6 people were killed and dozens were injured during the siege, which a prominent Palestinian human rights group denounced as a form of collective punishment. While the Zionist regime partially lifted the road closures earlier this month, the 21-day lockdown signaled a remarkable escalation of Israeli regime forces in a part of the West Bank that is, at least nominally, under the control of the Palestinian Authority. But the incursions and blockade of Nablus were only the latest in a growing series of Israeli regime acts of aggression in the West Bank that have put Palestinians on edge even before an Israeli regime escalation returned right-wing former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to power this month. While the territory, home to nearly 3 million people, has been under military occupation since 1967, and violence by the Zionist regime troops and settlers is relatively commonplace, the last few months have reminded residents of past surges in Israeli regime violence that were met with widespread Palestinian resistance, including during the Second Intifada of the early 2000s. You don't see the West Bank in the news like you see in Gaza. Because Gaza is bombed, you have these devastating images, videos, stories, it gets in the news, but even then, it dissipates. Yara Asi, a Palestinian-American researcher who was working in Nablus through the recent siege, told The Intercept, adding, "I think what obscures a situation that has been getting significantly worse in the West Bank. This is firmly within Area A, as designated by Oslo Accords," she added, referring to a breakdown of the occupied territories in different areas of control, with Area A being one theoretically under the civil and security control of the Palestinian Authority, adding, "So when you hear that Israeli regime jeeps have raided the city or that they have closed the city, this just belies the whole artifice that Oslo ever was, which is that there is any place of Palestinian sovereignty in the West Bank." The United Nations last month warned of an explosive situation as 2022 is on track to become the deadliest year in the West Bank since 2026, with at least 105 Palestinians, including 26 children, killed there, a 57% increase over the last year. The youngest 7-year-old, Rayan Soleiman, died of an apparent cardiac arrest after being chased by Israeli regime troops near the city of Beit Lahm. 10 Israeli citizens, 3 foreigners and 4 Israeli troops were killed by Palestinians from the West Bank in that time frame, according to the UN. But deaths are only one way to measure the worsening situation in the West Bank, where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians also face restricted mobility, land expropriation and economic hardships created by the occupation forces. Movement restrictions by way of the Zionist regime checkpoints and road closures in particular have been tightening, while attacks by settlers, often operating with the military's protection, have become more frequent. The olive harvesting season, when Palestinian farmers leave their villages to work in the groves, have become one of the most dangerous for them. Still, the almost routine reality of the violence Palestinians face has made it hard for observers to grasp at the big picture and take note of a perceptible shift that is further fueling anxiety and resentment. Only when you step back, you see just how alarming it is, how devastating this whole thing is, said Bhutto, stressing that violence is a built-in feature to the occupation. I am torn between saying this is an escalation and saying this is part of what we have lived through for 55 years. The whole world is shocked by other countries, but that shock doesn't apply here in the West Bank because it's been 55 years. Uncertainty in the West Bank has been thrown into further turmoil by the result of the Zionist regime's 50th election in 4 years earlier this month, which returned Netanyahu to power and is set to give the fabricated regime of Israel its most right-wing government ever. Some Palestinians note that what happens in Israeli regime politics doesn't change the reality of the occupation. They point to the Zionist regime violence over the last year as an effort by the former government to prove that it was as tough as the right-wing opposition. If anything, they add, Netanyahu's extremism exposes the reality of the Zionist regime's plans for continued expansion in the West Bank. It's too soon to predict whether the shift will last and how effective a new generation of Palestinian resistance groups can be. The fabricated regime of Israel's crackdown in recent months has led to the killing or arrest of much of the group's leadership, though support for them appears to be growing also in response to that crackdown. The dynamic is now new, while some form of armed resistance has remained a constant. Throughout the occupation, there have been surges in Palestinians' efforts to directly confront the Zionist regime forces, and they have been promptly met with Israeli regime repression. Every so many years, you see a willingness to re-engage with a broader armed resistance, which I think is shaped in part by a distance from the severe repression that the Israeli regime brings on Palestinians every time these uprisings begin to form, said Munayyer, a Palestinian activist. Whether mounting Israeli regime violence across the West Bank or over the last several months will plunge the territory back into the larger-scale fighting of the past remains in question, but it's a question Palestinians and others are increasingly voicing, with some referring to it as a simmering intifada, a big resistance. Munayyer said, I can't tell you how many times I have heard people say the next intifada has started. But I think what we are seeing reflects the overwhelming resistance of Palestinians against the Israeli regime forces. ¶¶ Meanwhile, Wafa news agency reported a Palestinian child was recently killed while four others were injured by the Zionist regime gunfire during confrontations that broke out with Israeli regime forces as the latter raided the eastern part of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. The ministry said in a statement that Ahmad Amjad Shahada, 16, was killed after Israeli regime forces shot him with a live bullet in the heart. The medical sources added that four other Palestinians were injured, one of them critically with a bullet in the abdomen, noting that one was hit with sound bomb in the head, while others suffered from suffocation due to inhaling toxic gas fired at them by the Zionist regime forces. According to Wafa correspondent, large units of Israeli regime forces accompanied by a military bulldozer raided the eastern area of Nablus in order to provide protection for the Zionist settlers, which sparked confrontations with Palestinians during which Israeli regime forces fired live bullets, sound toxic and tear gas bombs towards the protesters and their homes, killing one child and injured four others. The Israeli regime forces also targeted a Red Crescent vehicle with live bullets. Dozens of Israeli regime settlers raided the area of Joseph Tomb under protection from Zionist forces. With the Zionist regime killing of Shahada, the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli regime forces rises to 200, including 57 minors, according to reports by the Palestinian Ministry of Health.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very significant and interesting hadith. This hadith is about the characteristics of a foolish person, and it's been narrated from the Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam. You know, foolishness is one of those, you know, bad moral qualities. The Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam, is reported to have said, foolishness is the worst of diseases. And he also said the greatest poverty is foolishness. Right? So poverty is a very, foolishness is a very, bad trait, and we should try to avoid it. So how do we know if we're a foolish person or not? We have to look at these characteristics, and these characteristics of a foolish person have been narrated from the Prophet Jesus. The Prophet Jesus, alayhi salam, was once asked about the traits of a foolish person. In response to this question, he said, the foolish person is the one who is proud of himself and his own opinion. Pride is one of the characteristics of a foolish person. Who sees all good traits as coming from himself, and sees no one better than himself. He thinks that he's the best person, and that all of his qualities are good. Right. The Prophet Jesus then said, he has decided that all rights are his. He thinks that, you know, he has a right over everybody. You know, when he enters a room, he thinks that people should stand up for him. He thinks that, out of respect, he thinks people should respect him.